Miami, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, June the 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. ECOWAS, it is pleased so far with the conduct of Sunday's parliamentary elections in Guinea-Bissau.
The conduct of the election has been exemplary. In fact, no major incident has been recorded anywhere throughout the country. Voting has been very quiet, very transparent.
A prominent Ugandan opposition leader calls for a united front. A government spokesperson says Eswatini's judiciary is independent despite allegations by pro-democracy groups that King Nswati III controls the courts. Gambia calls for a peaceful resolution of the political crisis in neighboring Senegal. The UN Habitat Assembly opens in Nairobi today, Monday, as 51% of Africa's urban population is estimated to live in slums.
The fact that the urban population is increasing rapidly, and estimates indicate that by 2050, over 50% of populations in Africa would be living in urban areas, call for renewed investment in housing in urban areas.
And governments look to curb plastic pollution on this World Environment Day today, Monday. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's polls, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An official of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, says the sub-regional body is pleased so far with the conduct of Sunday's parliamentary elections in Guinea-Bissau. At stake is President Umaru Sisoko Mbalo's attempt to change the constitution and give himself more powers. The Guinea-Bissau elections come as two of the three most recent coups in West Africa have come when the leaders of those countries try to change their constitutions. Abdel Fattah Moussa is the ECOWAS Commissioner for Political Affairs and Security. He tells me that the conduct of the Guinea-Bissau elections shows that there is no alternative to a free and fair vote.
The conduct of the election has been exemplary. In fact, no major incident has been recorded anywhere throughout the country. Voting has been very quiet, very transparent. We just finished observing the concluding phases of the voting process today, and everything is very, very quiet. And I think, the country deserves praise for holding such elections in an environment of tension, difficulties, economic ones in the country. But still, we saw that turnout has been very impressive throughout the country, which is positive.
What does this mean, particularly for West Africa, in the midst of these coup d'etats in other countries? What does this particular election mean for ECOWAS?
In fact, that is what we have been promoting, that we have to promote transparent, inclusive, credible elections, because we've seen that elections have often served as a trigger, to crisis in the country. In Mali, the poorly conducted, managed legislative election triggered the first coup in the country in 2020. In Guinea, it was actually the fraudulent way the former president went about trying to entrench himself in power through a fraudulent referendum and other that also triggered the coup there. So we've got two of the three coups being partly a direct consequence of badly managed electoral processes. So trying to get elections right in Guinea-Bissau, and Guinea-Bissau with all its challenges to be able to deliver credible elections, it's a powerful message to the rest of the country that there is no alternative to the ballot box fairly conducted to select leaders.
Of course, before I let you go, Umaru Sisoko Mbalo, underneath is the concern about the possibility of any attempt to change the constitution. Is that of concern?
Well, that is what some observers have noted, and we should realize that constitutions can only be reviewed by the National Assembly in this country. There is no pathway for a referendum like has been done in some other places in the National Assembly. And from what we've observed so far, people are trying to say that the purpose of dissolving the National Assembly last May, a year now actually, was actually because there was a logjam in the parliament and nothing could pass through. So observers are saying his purpose is to get a clear majority so that he can push through with the constitutional reform. The majority of the people in the assembly want just clarification in the limits of powers of the branches of power under the semi-presidential system of government that operates here. But others are saying that President Mbalo want to shift the power dynamics more in favor of the executive, that is the president, and so he is seeking a parliamentary majority. From what we've seen so far, it is going to be incredibly difficult to get a clear majority for any of the blocs in the country.
Ambassador Musa, thank you so much. It's nice to reconnect, and thank you very much.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thank you, James.
Abdel Fattah Musa is the Commissioner for Political Affairs and Security of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. He was speaking with me from Guinea-Bissau's capital, Bissau. The United Nations Habitat Assembly opens in Nairobi today, Monday, and will last until June 9. Among the issues the conference is expected to address is sustainable development against the backdrop of pandemics, conflicts, climate change, and economic uncertainty. This comes as the World Bank estimates that 51% of Africa's urban population lives in slums and is expected to increase to 57% by 2050. Amnesty International has called on the Assembly to renew its commitment to the right to adequate housing for all. David Unjira is Amnesty's researcher for East Africa, the Horn, and the Great Lakes region. He tells me that governments must commit to upgrading housing, particularly in slums.
There is a challenge. Over the last couple of years, there has been an intense rural urban migration, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, as people, and especially young people, and our statement speaker to this extent, move to urban areas to look for opportunities. So as they move to urban areas, urban infrastructure needs to expand to accommodate the influx of people moving to get opportunities. And you and I agree that there are more opportunities in urban areas than rural areas. If you look at one of the issues that the Assembly will be looking at is the question of housing in urban informal settlement. Of course, rural areas also, but urban informal settlement. Being that it has become a dent in the urban spaces in sub-Saharan Africa, where we are speaking about housing in terms of adequate housing, but also speaking about housing in terms of affordability of the housing. So it's not about just about the numbers of houses, it's also about the affordability of those houses. And so the fact that the urban population is increasing rapidly, and estimates indicate that by 2050, over 50% of populations in Africa would be living in urban areas, call for renewed investment in housing in urban areas.
Renew investment in housing, because I'm looking at the statistics here. World Bank estimates that 51% of Africa's 500 urban population live in slums. That is interesting, especially when you talk about migration from the rural areas.
So there were commitments that were made in 2019, but this was before COVID-19. Now, COVID-19 slowed all progress because governments shifted their priorities from other social investment programs into fighting the disease. In the process, they took a lot of loans to manage the disease, but also to deal with the COVID aftershock. Now, the consequence is a lot of budgets are being redirected towards managing the debt that was taken to manage COVID. And so there is a concern that that is why we're calling for renewal, because whatever plans were put in place, whatever strategies governments had, most of them were disrupted by COVID, which has now redirected resources away from social services into debt repayment and debt servicing general. So that's why we are saying we need to rethink everything in the context of the COVID aftershock.
So you are suggesting that African governments invest more in public housing?
Yes, in social housing, that is public housing in urban informal settlements, but housing that meets the international standards. So the housing is not just a house, it must also meet sanitation standards, but it must also be affordable and accessible.
David Unjira is Amnesty International's researcher for East Africa, the Horn, and the Great Lakes region. He was speaking with us from Nairobi, Kenya. The Gambia is calling for a peaceful resolution of the political crisis in neighboring Senegal, where 16 people have been reported killed following 3 days of protest. Reuters reported Sunday that Dakar has cut access to mobile internet services in certain areas because of the protest. In a statement released on Sunday, President Adama Barrow's government cited Senegal's strong democratic institutions and proven track record as a respected negotiator and peace builder in the sub-region. Gambian government spokesperson Ibrahima Sankare tells me that the Gambians are concerned because of the historical close ties between the Gambia and Senegal.
The two countries are divided by a historical factor, which is colonialism. Absent colonial factor, it is difficult to actually distinguish the difference between Gambia and Senegal. We have the same culture, the same customs, the same cuisine, the same languages. And every other day, Senegalese marry Gambians and Gambians marry Senegalese. In fact, there is hardly a Gambian family or a Senegalese family that doesn't have, you know, either part of the other country in that family. If a person dies in Senegal, it's a Gambian who is also killed in Senegal and vice versa. And if you remember very well, in 1981, we had a very bloody attempted coup d'etat here that failed, thanks to the Senegalese government at the time, because we have this relationship that if there is problems in Senegal or Gambia, either government would have to help, you know, to make sure that they restore sanity. So the 1981 coup d'etat failed thanks to Senegalese intervention. Again, in 2016, December, when the former dictator Yahya Jammeh, you know, refused to relinquish power after failing the presidential elections, the Senegalese president Macky Sall, you know, with the United Nations and the other African governments came together and they created a West Africa peacekeeping force that eventually forced Yahya Jammeh to flee. So again, were it not Senegal, it is highly probable President Adama Barrow would not have been president of the Gambia.
So what do you say if somebody in Senegal thinks that Gambia should not interfere in the internal affairs of Senegal?
Yes, the press release, if you read it very well, is very cautiously worded, just to avoid any feelings of the kind in question that your question is trying to provoke. If you look at the disturbances in Senegal, for instance, the destruction of Cheikh Anta Diop University is an enormous loss, not only to Senegal, not only to Gambia, but the entire African subcontinent. Many people, particularly in the Gambian civil service, and even ministers, cabinet ministers in our government, are actually graduates of Cheikh Anta Diop University and so many other places that we are burned down by the demonstrators. So honestly, it is not interfering in their internal political dynamics, but is actually sharing a feeling of sadness. And that's why the president of the Gambia, President Barrow, is calling for a peaceful solution to this crisis.
Ibrahima Sankara is the Gambian government spokesperson. He was speaking with me from the capital, Banjul. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, June 5th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. Ugandan opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye is rallying the opposition to unite. Besigye, a four-time presidential candidate, says all forces of change must work together to unseat the long-ruling National Resistance Movement Party. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakariji has more from Kampala.
Speaking at an opposition-organized workshop on constitutional and electoral reforms in Kampala on Friday, retired Colonel Kizza Besigye says opposition leaders must work together and put divisions behind them.
We have parties that are competing for power. And so even we compete amongst ourselves. The prisoners, the ones who have no power, are competing amongst themselves also. Find people, me I'm red, me I'm blue, me I'm green, me I'm white, you are nothing.
Besigye has four times not conceded defeat, claiming the elections were rigged in favor of the incumbent Museveni, who has been in power for close to 40 years. He says opposition leaders have to sensitize citizens to know and demand their constitutional and democratic rights.
Let's get together and seek the real power first for the population, make ourselves a new constitution that we believe in. Hopefully that constitution will, among many things, cure the problem of holding all that power in the center here.
Robert Chagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, is the leader of the National Unity Platform, Uganda's largest opposition party.
Ugandans yearn for a country where there is electoral integrity, where every election is a testament to the will of the people. A country where the voice of the people is respected and where their votes carry the weight of their hopes and their aspirations. We want a country where democracy thrives, where the media is free.
Opposition leaders here did not say when and whether they will form some kind of alliance in future. For Daybreak Africa, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
A spokesperson for the government of Eswatini says the country's judiciary is independent despite allegations by pro-democracy groups that King Mswati III controls the court. The comment comes after a judge found two pro-democracy members of parliament guilty on terrorism charges on last Thursday. Basidi Mambuzi and Ntandani Dube had been in jail since their arrest in 2021 while attempting to present a resolution in parliament demanding direct public participation in the election of their prime minister. The U.S. Embassy in Eswatini has expressed deep disappointment by the guilty verdict. Government spokesperson Alpheus Zumalo says the U.S. Embassy should not interfere in the country's internal affairs. He tells me that the government is pleased with the verdict, although he says there is still room for the two MPs to appeal the verdict.
We believe on our part, on the basis of the allegations that were leveled against them, justice has taken its course. And we are quite aware that yet it is the lower courts of the land that have found them guilty on these charges. We are also quite aware that a judgment in terms of the sentencing is yet to happen. And we are also quite aware of the rights that the accused have in terms of an opportunity to appeal the judgment or even the conviction itself if they don't feel satisfied.
So do you believe that justice was done?
We really believe justice was done. Looking at the chaos that was caused to the economy of the country, looking at the properties of Emaswati, the sovereign Emaswati, individually and business-wise, that was damaged into the tune of billions, looking at the debt figures, the numbers which are not yet even confirmed, around 34 of the rioters that died on the night when they staged the so-called protest. Of course, the lives that were lost on that fateful night cannot be recovered as such.
As you know, the U.S. Ambassador to Eswatini has expressed disappointment with the guilty verdict, and I'm sure other human rights groups were following. For example, how does the charge against these two MPs become terrorist charge when, in fact, they are members of parliament who are supposed to speak on behalf of their constituency?
We are appealed and we have already expressed government position with regard to the conduct of the American embassy and ambassador into the Kingdom of Eswatini of interfering with the judicial verdict of the court in the country. When three or four or five rioters, which were found guilty by the court in the U.S. for having instigated the riots of January 6th in Washington, D.C., the Kingdom of Eswatini did not question the sentences which were given to those rioters. You are quite aware of that. We have urged and requested the American ambassador and embassy in the Kingdom of Eswatini to do the noble and the only honorable thing, which is not to violate the Vienna Convention of 1961, especially Article 41, which prevents ambassadors from interfering into the internal domestic affairs of the receiving country.
Alpheus Zumalo is the Eswatini government spokesperson. He was speaking with us from the capital, Mbabane. Activists say World Environment Day today, Monday, is a reminder of the effects of human behavior on plastic pollution. According to the United Nations, every year, over 400 million tons of waste are produced worldwide, with only one-third being used just once. In Africa, the private sector is working to reduce the problem by recycling plastic. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
Over 1 million marine animals, including mammals, fish, sharks, turtles, and birds, are killed each year due to plastic debris in the ocean. According to UNESCO, figures on marine pollution, there are at least 100 million tons of plastic in the ocean around the world. United Nations Environment Program UNEP Executive Director Inga Anderson says reusing, recycling, reorienting, and diversifying systems that manage plastic waste is the only way to tackle the problem.
Recycling is not the sole solution, nor the magic bullet. Our system simply can't cope. Change has to happen across the whole life cycle of plastics. We must refuse unnecessary single-use items. We must redesign products and packaging to use less plastic.
She says everyone must play their part to ensure plastic pollution is managed.
Governments can deliver a strong outcome on the deal to end plastic pollution, which is currently under negotiation. And businesses can adopt a life cycle approach. And the financial sector can put its capital right behind this very transformation that we need to see. And we, citizens, we can use our voices, our votes, and our wallets to drive change.
Businesses are driving innovation and market development through technology and infrastructure upgrades and by supporting the plastic sector in managing plastic waste and recycling. I am Maureen Ojiambo in Sacramento, California.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in Ghana, where the Black Princesses of Ghana has won the maiden under 20 WAFU B tournament after defeating Nigeria's Falconets on penalty in Saturday's final in Kumasi. After a 1-1 draw at regulation time, both sides went into penalties, where Ghana under 20 girls won 3-1 after regulation time. In the third place match played earlier, Burkina Faso beat Benin Republic 2-1 to become third best team in the championships hosted by Ghana. The under 20 women's tournament was organized by the West African Football Union. Staying with football news, Al Ahly maintained their unbeaten home record against Wydad Casablanca in the CAF Champions League after triumphing 2-1 in the first leg of the final at the Cairo International Stadium on Sunday night. Al Ahly had never lost to Wydad at home in the competition. Coach Marcel Kohler's side will once again try to consolidate on the first leg victory of defeating the reigning African champions when the two teams meet in the second leg clash on June the 11th. In Uganda, Vipers SC walked away from the 2022-2023 football season with a double after winning both the Uganda Premier League Cup and the Uganda Cup. The Kitende Bay side on Saturday beat Police FC 1-0 to win the Uganda Cup final held at the Akibwa Stadium in Lira. Milton Karisa scored the only goal of the game in the first half to hand coach Alex Isibirie a second successful Ugandan Cup title. And now to athletics. The Races Grand Prix, a World Athletics Continental Tour silver meeting, made a successful return on Saturday after a three-year hiatus. South African world record holder and two-time world champion Wade van Niekerk demonstrated he's getting back to his best form after winning the men's 400 meters A final in a meeting record of 44.21 seconds. Another African success saw world champion and world record holder Tobia Musson of Nigeria winning the women's 100 meters hurdles in the season's best of 12.57 seconds. Staying with athletics, world and Olympic 1,500 meters champion Faith Kipyegon said she was surprised to break and set the world record at this stage of the year. The two-time Olympic champion and mother of one delivered a sensational performance in Florence to set a new 1,500 meters world record of 3 minutes 49.11 seconds. The 29-year-old Kenyan says she plans to transition fully to 5,000 meters after the Paris Olympic Games next year.
I didn't expect to run a world record. I was looking forward to run a world lead, which was 3:54. But I didn't I didn't expect a world record. This just came as a surprise, and I really thank God.
And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, June 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team,